complex concepts in a language you understand and a language based on your worldview gives you an advantage. However, those who have an advantage in our education system are only those who are descendants or have adopted the colonial culture and language. This further entrenches inferiority and superiority complexes. Now, you may say that African languages have not developed enough in the past decade to carry complex concepts encompassed in our education. I would agree with you, which is why I'm speaking in English right now. But would say it is an easily remedied problem if our linguists are willing to play ball. For the development of language is not merely Africanizing European terms, but finding ways to explain them within the worldview of its speakers. For example, you cannot translate television by calling it e-television. You must explain it within the context of the worldview of its speakers. As we do, we call it umabonakude, that which shows things that are not in your immediate environment. Coming to the African worldview, I believe that when Bantu Steve Biko spoke of Africa giving the world a more human face, he was referring to harmonious spiritual understanding and interaction of the African with her world. The reverence given to nature and the social cohesiveness as enshrined in the Ubuntu philosophy. But to give a human face to the world, Africa must first rediscover her own humanity. Biko spoke of this at length, that the aggressive dehumanization that blacks, particularly Africans, suffered had to be met with an equally aggressive rehumanization to infuse back life into the empty husk of the black man. What is this self-love you spoke of? Is it not the love for what makes an African human, what informs the humanity of an African? Is it not her worldview, her knowledge systems, her spirituality? Would it then not be fair to say that the beginning of the emancipation of an African starts with embracing her worldview, her knowledge systems? If language is a repository of the worldview of its speakers, let South Africa speak, be taught, and do business in an African language. If development is seen as a sustainable social, cultural, economic, and technological transformation of society, let South Africa speak, be taught, and do business in an African language. If no society in the world has developed in a sustained and democratic fashion on the basis of a borrowed colonial language, let South Africa speak, be taught, and do business in an African language. I believe that any African language carries the worldview of all African ethnic groupings. It is the worldview that gave birth to language. I say this because across the African landscape, cultural practices devoid of colonial intrusion are the same, of course, give or take some slight differences. This is not to say that Africans live and have always lived in harmonious existence. It would be naive to believe so. History belies the fact that tribes across the globe have always had their conflicts. This, however, does not dismiss the fact that tribes of Africa, as with tribes of Europe, have strong cultural ties that bind. Our worldview as Africa has given birth to our knowledge systems and our culture. These are the ties that bind. To strengthen them is to strengthen and fast-track development. Ethnocentricity will not help the development of South Africa. We need to remember that we were Bantu way before we were Zulu, Venda, Tsonga, Sotho, etc. Deny it if you will, but English is what brings us together as people of South Africa. And English is slowly eroding all the other languages and eroding African culture. We have a wealth of information that we are not tapping into. Africa is a rich continent, yet its inhabitants are poor. It is poor because we want to be importers of knowledge and innovation instead of exporters of such. This is a sure path to neocolonialism, and this time we'll have no one but ourselves to blame if opportunists ransack and pillage our continent a second time while we continue to have famine in Somalia, Sudan, Ethiopia, while we continue to have majority of Africans living on 550 rand a month. Culturally, education in Africa can only be seen in this context for it to have any real impact on our overall evolution. Education must teach African excellence in a language that has the ability to carry the worldview from which stems thousands of years of Africa's knowledge. At the World Conference on Science held in Budapest in 1999, the acknowledgement and endorsement by the global scientific community of the relevance of indigenous knowledge speaks to this vacuum we have left in the global community by our involuntary and now increasingly voluntary abandonment of our knowledge systems. Spiritually, we do not know why we are here on earth. We do not know how or why we developed in such diverse ways, but increasingly we are finding that our individual cultural uniqueness puts us in a position to have information that the other does not have. We are finding that to keep our planet not only progressive but healthy, we all need to contribute to the global information pool. We are finding that to keep humanity healthy of mind and body, we all need to contribute to the global spiritual pool. The question then is, what does Africa currently have to contribute to the world? How much more time do I have? Okay. I will end there. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Dana, for the presentation. I wish I had more minutes, sorry. That's the rule. Now, another member's question. I know it's after lunch. Questions? Honorable Lepret? Honorable Shabalala? What was the meal for lunch? What did people have for lunch? Meat? Oh no, I understand. That's why I was sitting here. Okay, can I take the two questions for now?
Thank you, Chair. I think Ms. Dana made quite an impassioned plea for our African languages and indigenous knowledge. I would like to know from you whether you are of opinion that this bill that we are discussing will in any way contribute to the promotion of African languages.
Okay. The second question, Maureen Shabalala.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks, Ms. Dana, for gracing this occasion. I think mine is just to really ask from where you are sitting, because I think much in your speech, you are touching much around African languages and the importance for us to make sure that we promote them, but we also incorporate them and move from away from the colonization. I think I want to appreciate that from your speech that you are articulating that. I want to find out what is it that you think we can do as South African citizens from where we're sitting to be united around the issue and ensure we get more artists, not only artists, but we're saying citizens in our own country to be involved in the struggle to say that it is important for us to acknowledge where we're coming from, but to ensure that we embrace who we are in our own languages. Thanks.
Thanks. My question would be, in what you have written, especially on business-to-business language in Africa, do you believe that this bill must go beyond a government communications? Do you believe that if we do business-to-business in our African languages, it will be much feasible, or will it be more productive? Okay. Members, I'll just allow you to answer those three questions. Then if you still have some questions, I'll give you another round. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. The first one was, will the bill contribute to the promotion of indigenous languages? I would really hope so, because if you heard me, I touched on the issue of us failing our children. Because they come from environments where they have their own mother tongue, and then when they get to their school environment, they are forced to learn in a foreign language, which I do believe that it is grossly unfair, because imagine if you were to take your English-speaking child and take them to a Kwasa school where they've never even heard of this language before, and now they must learn all these complex ideas or concepts in Xhosa. You know, you are not only killing their self-esteem for years to come, you're also putting them at a disadvantage when it comes to how they assimilate information. So I would hope that this bill would go beyond and be implemented in schools. There is proof that if a child for the first 8 years of their lives they are taught in their own mother tongue while they're learning some other language, then they are able to switch much better and with understanding of the concepts from one language to another later in life, and it won't affect their self-esteem at all. I believe that the pass rates that we're seeing in the country are a lot to do with the issue of language. I went on an education tour around the country, and I found that when the children express themselves in their own language, they're very passionate, they're very open, they're very free, and they're very confident. When you switch their language, they start acting stupid, like, you know, they're the dumbest kids, and you can see how it affects their self-esteem. And you also find that even the teachers themselves cannot speak this language properly. And but they will still complain that, you know, these children are not grasping the language, but the problem is that they themselves don't understand the language. So I think we're doing our country a huge disservice by continuing to uphold English as a main language of instruction in schools. So I would hope that this bill would influence that. And then you asked what can we do. I think I answered your question also. And then when it comes to business, it's not something that can be done overnight. Definitely not. If we can start with grade zero now and have them up till matric, then maybe when they are finished with their studies and they start to work, they will be able to then use an African language to communicate. I know that Kiswahili is a huge language on the continent, because we have to look way beyond just SA. You know, we live in a beautiful continent, a very rich continent, and if we can do business with each other more than, if we can have the money circulating on the continent instead of going outside, you know, we would be a much more prosperous continent, and we could help fix poverty and the lack of education much quicker. Thank you.
Usekho na omnye umbuzo? Bawunje qala. Okanye sabhideyile le nzwakazi. Okay, uyaphendula ngesikhosi. Okay. Mam, sorry.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to thank you for this comprehensive lecture that you gave us. But I want to check with you, how would the issues that you submitted, they unite us as a country, language speaking, on a language base? How can we unite everybody here? What's the best method of uniting everyone? Through language, I'm checking with you. Thank you.
Kona omnye umbuzo? June. What was the lunch? Meat and what? Okay. Next time it will be fruits only. Any other members of the group? Don't call and doesn't put a couple of bandages. Okay. I think they will lean in. Okay, Mr.
I also wrote an article about us needing a unifying African language, which was not so well received by the Africans. They were very mad at me because they felt like I was bringing them back to apartheid, where one language rules over everyone else. But I felt like where they're being short-sighted is the fact that right now what unifies us is English. Would we rather have that, you know, which comes with its own inferiority complexes for us, you know, and like I said, it does not help Africans innovate because it does not carry African knowledge systems. I believe that we need an African language. I said that the first 8 years of a child, they should be taught in their mother tongue, but I believe that while that is happening, they should also be taught another African language, and then English. That would then be the language of communication for the country. What that language is, would be something that we'd all have to decide. Whether maybe we completely go out of the country and take Kiswahili because we're too divided to choose isiZulu or whatever other language that is most commonly spoken. But I do believe that because language carries our culture and we will better evolve when we're basing our works around who we are as a people and who we have been for thousands and thousands of years. And also, like I mentioned, I believe that all the different African languages, based on our cultures, there is somewhere where they have a similar source. They are both based on the same worldview, because it is a worldview, how we see our world, that gives birth to a language, and that gives birth to a culture. So if our cultures are similar, then it means that we are similar people. There should be no issue, there should be no threat of one losing their identity if they switch from Sesotho to isiXhosa, to isiZulu, to isiTsonga, because it's the same way of life, the same way of being.
Thank you, honorable members, and I think if there are no further questions, Ms. Dunn, I would like to thank you very much for your submission to the public hearings. Okay, thanks a lot. I think some people are sleepy now. The next person on the program is the F.W. de Klerk Foundation, which is a presentation will be made by Advocate Debris. Where is he? Oh. While he's on his way, Ms. Dana said something very interesting, which I also experienced, that you find teachers not understanding the same language if it's able to express in front of this class. It's very true. Okay. Thank you. Now we'll have the advocate to pray. Am I correct? Yes. From the FDA, the W. de Klerk Foundation. Thank you.
Madam Chair, honorable members, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for this opportunity on behalf of the F.W. de Klerk Foundation. I'm an advocate and operations officer with the foundation. I came across an amazing quote the other day regarding language, which says that language is the roadmap of a culture. It tells you where its people are, where they came from, and also where they are going. And in light of the above, we welcome the idea of addressing this issue, but also we wish to raise certain concerns with the proposed 2011 Languages Bill, which will become the new South African Languages Act, if it is indeed accepted by Parliament. We welcome this opportunity to assist the honourable members, because to draft the Languages Act for South Africa with our official languages, it's no easy task. In this sense, then, further, we must all just remember that languages, for all us as South Africans, our constitutional fathers saw languages for all of us as such an important principle that this was included in the founding principles of our constitution. Now, the spin-off effect of this is that if the rights and the founding principles, in other words, then also languages, if this is watered down, other rights in the constitution are also watered down. The converse is also true. If the rights and the founding principles, or the ideas in the founding principles of the Constitution, are promoted, then also other rights will be promoted in the Constitution. In general, our Constitution makes broad provision for the safeguard of language rights. It recognizes all our official languages, and then also a whole plethora of other languages. In Cape Town, I mean, only on the streets, there's lots of jumbos and salam alaikums, and so forth, and so forth. It recognizes further, and specifically, that the official other languages shall enjoy parity of esteem as well as equitable use. That's in Section 6 of the Constitution. And that national and provincial government must use at least 2 official languages. It also makes provision for the Pan-South African Language Board and declares that where it is reasonably practicable, everyone has the right to receive education in the official language of their choice in public educational systems. And then for the Estabrit Clark Foundation, paramount are the following 3 factors when we speak about the 2011 Languages Bill. We need to look at the 2003 Languages Bill, and we need to look at Section 6.4 of the Constitution, the words priority of esteem and equitable use. And lastly, the broad but very, very important principle of multilingualism. I think I should start off by saying that the Foundation would like to see, as a starting point, the 2003 bill reintroduced in the legislative process. Why do we say this? The 2003 bill, in our view, was a practical piece of legislation. Because if we want to solve language issues in our country, we need to look at it pragmatically and practically. It was a practical piece of legislation, whereas we believe the 2011 bill is not. And it does not allow them to provide a rigid and legalistic document. In simple terms, the 2011 bill does less to promote the language provisions of the Constitution than the 2003 bill. If we look at the 2003 bill, it sought to promote South Africa's linguistic diversity by encouraging respect for language rights. It promoted multilingualism, and this is exactly what Section 6.4 of the Constitution requires. The 2003 bill promoted equitable use of all the official languages. It would better enable all South Africans to use the official language of their choice. And then further, we believe it provided a very satisfactory regulatory framework to facilitate effective implementation of the constitutional obligations concerning multilingualism. This is not done by the 2011 bill. Why do I say this is not done by the 2011 bill? If I can quickly just refer to further commendable provisions of the 2003 bill, which have been completely omitted from the 2011 bill. The 2003 bill contained a clause setting out clearly the objects of the bill and entrenched the concept of multilingualism. The 2003 bill also had a very praiseworthy and practical set of guiding principles for when the bill was to be interpreted. And here it's very interesting because we've touched on this point now of sign language, a very important point. Section 3.1b of the 2003 Languages Bill specifically asks for the promotion of all indigenous and sign languages. And this has been completely omitted from the 2011 bill. The 2003 bill further had a language policy clause providing for the implementation of all 11 official languages on a rotational basis, thus giving practical effect to the most part of esteem and equitable use or equitable treatment. And then we also know that the 2003 bill made provision for language units with a wide array of powers, and this included a streamlined cooperative role with the Pan-South African Language Board. And then, furthermore, the 2003 bill, in our view, gave a decisive and centralized role to the Pan-South African Language Board. And this is not done by the 2011 bill. And then, a very, very important clause that was left out completely in the 2011 bill was a remedies clause, setting out in clear and unambiguous terms the remedies available to any or all aggrieved parties in any language issue or disputes. Just a couple of specifics, and here are the members, if you have a copy in front of you of our submission, just page 5, where we make specific submissions regarding the language policy. We believe that if one looks at a bill which seeks to introduce a language policy where there's 11 official languages at stake, it should be in our country with our provinces follow a very pragmatic regional approach. We feel that such a policy, in other words, a pragmatic regional approach, will contribute to the development of our indigenous languages. And also, a pragmatic regional approach will align this with the 2003 rotational implementation, where we had the different language groups. And this has been voted for the 2011 bill. We have the submission that each government department at the national level should adopt 2 official languages on the following basis, of which one would in all probability be English, but then 1/3 of government departments. She chose that second language from the first group of other languages, which is isiXhosa, isiZulu, isiNdebele, and the Siswati language group. The second part would be the Sepedi, Sesotho, and the Setswana language group. And then the third language group, from which the other language will take over, Afrikaans, Tivenda, and the Zitsonga language groups. And then one can filter it down to government at the provincial level, where, let's make it for practical purposes, one of the languages will be English, but then specifically, the second language will be the language that is most widely used or spoken in that province, to give practical effect to that province and its language needs. And then also, if one takes it down further, to the provincial departments, also, let's use English, but then also the language that is most widely spoken and used within that region or within that province. And then at a municipal level, we service the delivery that is most acute and most effectively or most non-effectively felt by our people. Again, let's look at the usage of English, and then specifically the second or even an additional language at municipal level must be the language that is most usually or most widely spoken or used within that municipality or within that region. Another factor which I would just like to heighten is the development of our indigenous languages. And this is mandated by the Constitution in Article or in Section 6.2. And here, there was an earlier question raised by one of the honourable members right at the end, where a question was posed earlier to one of our colleagues about what the issue is with our universities and languages. And then to tie within that question, the point was raised by Dr. Nova Alexander, a wonderful point, which he termed this habitus of English. We proposed that the minister should, in consultation with relevant or certain identified universities, approve the university or certain universities to promote the use and development of our indigenous or our unique South African languages with a view to make those languages academic languages. And he made the point further, one day we can build an atomic bomb with its instructions in Northern Sotho or in isiXhosa. But we can utilize, and how do we do this? We must start at the education level, and then why not utilize our universities to make them, again what Dr. Michael Lekordeur said, make the universities custodians, appoint certain core universities as custodians of certain core indigenous languages, and develop the languages in that sense. Further, what is a language bill or a language act without the necessary teeth to enforce it? It's paper law. So how do we do about the altering and the regulation of the use of our official languages? We would submit, and I would humbly submit, that we already have the existing framework and the infrastructure through the Pan-South African Language Board. There's no need for duplication. The board already has sufficient powers in terms of Section 8 of the Pan-South African Languages Act to monitor language issues. And we feel strongly that the 2003 bill, as I have already said, gave a centralized and decisive role to the Pan-South African Language Board, and this is not done by the 2011 bill. And this is a severe let's call it a severe omission in our view. Support for the Pan-South African Language Board, then, to pursue this goal, the Minister should provide the necessary support to the Pan-South African Languages Board to assist in this function. And here also, the issue of funds, or the making available of funds, will always be a core issue. And then, it was earlier also touched upon by one of the honourable members. One of our submissions, and if I can refer the honourable members to page 8 of our submissions, is the creation of the Office of a Language Ombudsman. And the goal of such an ombudsman would obviously be to hear issues and complaints regarding language issues and language disputes. Whether this should be without or outside the framework of the Pan-South African Language Board, I cannot say, because that will have obvious cost implications. We believe that within the already existing framework of PANSUB, there is certainly room to maneuver for such a or an Office of the Language Ombudsman. Specifically then, to give teeth to this monitoring and the regulation of our language provisions. And then, I would like to end off just by saying that we think and we feel, as I'm sure all of you do, that it's crucial that legislation pertaining to languages in South Africa must enshrine the status of all official languages and give effect to Section 6 of the Constitution, specifically Section 6.4. It's fundamental because it will ensure that all our languages are properly developed, enjoy parity of esteem, and enjoy equitable treatment or use. And this is exactly what the Constitution requires. And we feel that we should never lose sight of what our Constitution says. And with that, I thank you.
Advocate Prince, I think the first question must come from me this time. On the basis of your submission on page 5 and 6 on the issue of language policy, in every of the submissions you have said one of the provincial languages will be English, one of the national languages will be English, one of the municipal languages will be English. It's a personal question to say I have a problem with that, but maybe you'll clarify me why you say English. Because as earlier on I raised an issue to say that in the Northern Cape no English is spoken. Because I'm a very curious person, I just want to share this quickly. Unfortunately, no, it won't eat on your time, don't worry. The language is mostly spoken in South Africa. In the Eastern Cape, if it's 83%, Afrikaans is 9%. Then the others follow, like English. Just make an example. Sesotho in the Free State is 64%, Afrikaans is 12%. I'm just raising on not only to you, not because you have raised it, but it's something that I've read. IsiZulu in KwaZulu-Natal, IsiZulu is 81%, English 13%. In Limpopo, Sepedi is 52%, Setsonga 22%, and Tshivenda 16%. Mpumalanga, Eswati is 31%. Northwest, Setswana is 65%, Afrikaans is 7%. In here in the Western Cape, Afrikaans is 55%, Xhosa is 23%, then English is 19%. So, unfortunately, I raised it when we were coming on board. It's one of them that I was raising them. How would we say now English must be an official, one of the official languages whereby the population of those provinces or is mostly those languages. And in South Africa, only 8% of the households, their mother tongue is English. The rest of the 92% is not English. So, I thought that's the question that I'm asked. Why is the foundation saying? Because this is what we're trying to phase out now, to say that we're making English, the master language, I'll say, or, okay. Okay, that's my question. I see some hands are boiling down there. You're an advocate, so you're used to this. Okay. I can see another Shabalala. Yes. I've called the correct name now.
Thanks, Shepherdson. Yes. I think let me welcome also the submissions. But you see, you keep on making reference to the 2003 bill. And when I look into the current bill, all these promotions that you are talking about, those things are there in the current bill of 2011. Most of the things that you are referring to the 2003. I would want you to really distinguish really scientifically where you are sitting now to say what makes you feel confident enough to say to us the 2003 is better than the 2011. As a matter of fact, your own language that you use, you say that it's a real omission when you look at it. So, therefore, if it's an omission, what makes it better if this is the same thing that you're looking at? That's what I want you to clarify. I also want to come to the issue to say you've given us three preferential language groups in your own way or in your own research that you think you can make it work, and this is should be the first group. So what informs that? So I would want you qualitatively to tell me from where I'm sitting, convince me in terms of how did you arrive and qualify that? How did you arrive to say this is the preferential groupings? Because I can argue that, especially when you group languages, African ones, indigenous, and say that these are the groupings when it comes to, when you speak about Nguni languages. they're clarified. These Nguni languages, and you've mixed them around when you speak about your preferential. So I want you to qualify that. Another issue is that from where I'm sitting, that you are agreeing to the board and you are saying that you would therefore make a submission to say the minister therefore should provide support and so forth and so on. So I also want to find out about that, where you're saying that you are agreeing to the 2011 as well, you are saying minister should further provide support. So I find a bit contradictory to say you're not very comfortable with it, but further there are things that you think they can be improved upon. So I think there should be clarification. The last one, you're talking about the teething problems in the 2003 and 2011 for monitoring and evaluation. Indeed, there is teething issues. When you provide something that is new, when you've got the old thing that has not worked, the reasons why you bring the new thing is because you want something to work. You want to see action. You want to see change. You want to improve. That's why you bring something new. So I have a worry if you want to make us refer backwards and not even want to move forward and make recommendations that will be able to align with what you are bringing. Because I think you are making good submissions, but to me they are almost as if they are rhetoric to what the 2011 is suggesting. The last point, the reason why we are communicating, Chairperson, yes, touch me, ne? I'm preaching now. The reason why we need language in South Africa and communicate better is because we want to communicate. That's why we want language to make it work. I don't think, Chairperson, from where we're moving and listen to presentation from in the morning, the issue has been about lobbying for better language. What is better use in provinces? What is a better language? We're at national level here. As much as we might talk about provinces and say provinces, this can work for you, Sepedi, Limpopo, or whatever the story, but at a national level, what can it make it work? So I want you to assist me from where you're sitting and give me your preferential language, because that's what has been happening, is that I think what's important is Afrikaans first and there's an English first. The national question here is better communication for a civil, for an ordinary person to be able to get communication from a national government department, accessible in communications for us to be able to communicate to an ordinary person. And that is a national question that we need to answer rather than preferring which better language it is. Let me end there. Thanks, sir.
That's why I'm a proud member of the ANC league.
In Afrikaans, we say there's a mouthful.
Oh, okay. Is it more than enough?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, I'll, okay, members, I'm coming.
In Afrikaans, we say that's a mouthful. Just the first question by the chair on why we propose English, if indeed the statistics show that probably other languages are the dominant languages just on the numbers in certain areas or certain regions, why we propose English? And also, firstly, I would like to make it very clear that as the fund, from the foundation perspective, first and foremost, we would like to see the development of all of South Africa's indigenous languages. And that actually excludes English, as we all know. So why we propose English is certainly just from a purely practical point of view. As it has been pointed out by one of our colleagues who spoke earlier, at this stage it would seem that English is indeed one of the factors that unites us as South Africans. So it's a language that a lot of South Africans speak. It's a business. It's a language of business. It's a language of governance. So it would be, I think I would make the submission that it would be hard to see where South Africa is now, a situation where we seek to do business with one another and where government would seek to enforce its provisions without the utilization of English. That's why we propose a very definitive development of all our indigenous languages, but I would submit very humbly that we cannot at this stage, while we are and while we have developed since 1994 regarding the language issue, we cannot lose sight of what English has done and the role that English is to play. Even, I mean, if we look at our education sector as well, I mean, we cannot lose scope of what English is. And I hope that answers your question, Madam Chair, of why we propose a combination, if it were to be seen like that, of the development of our indigenous languages, but then also this idea that we cannot, I don't want to say unfortunately, but we cannot lose sight of English and the practical use thereof at this stage. Then, to go to the questions by the other, first, just why do I make reference to the 2003 bill? And If I understand it, the first question correctly, it was said that because this is how it is, because most of the things included in the 2003 bill are in the 2011 bill. If you would bear with me. In my submissions, or at least what I tried to submit verbally, is that in the 2003 bill, there are specific sections which have been omitted from the 2011 bill. And this was the clause contained, and when I say this now, what I mean now is specifically the clauses that were present in the 2003 bill, which were specifically omitted as a whole from the 2011 bill. The first one was the objects bill. And I know there's an objects bill in the 2011 bill, but it differs from the 2003 bill. So my submission on that score would simply be that we would rather see the reintroduction of the 2003 clause and the objects therein contained. And also, if I can just go and try and answer the question step by step or on a step by step basis, there's a set of guiding principles, and as the Honourable Member knows, there's no set of guiding principles in the 2011 bill. That has been completely omitted as a whole. Whereas in the 2003 bill, I think it is contained right underneath the object. There's a practical and wonderful set of guiding principles for whenever the 2003 bill was to be interpreted or implemented. And that has been completely omitted from the 2011 bill. There's no such clause in the 2011 bill. And also, I know that there's a language policy clause in the 2011 bill, and I mean, I respect that, but I think the submission that I'm trying to get across is that we would prefer the language policy as it was described in the 2003 bill. And then also, the reason why I say that is it describes the implementation of certain languages on a rotational basis. And the reason why I make that submission is that we feel that that language policy clause in the 2003 bill, according to us, would have probably been in a better position to elevate the status of the indigenous languages and promote, or at least assist in the promotion of the indigenous and formerly marginalized languages. And there also are other provision in the new bill for the language units, certainly, but we would prefer the language units and the description thereof as it was set out in the 2003 bill. And then also, something I feel very, very strongly about in trying to further assist and answer the question is the role to be played by BANSALT. BANSALT, there were generous portions of the 2003 bill dedicated to the role to be played by BANSALT, which is not done in the 2011 bill. And then, I think, and possibly many of my colleagues who also presented submissions will agree with this, one of the most important omissions from the 2011 bill was the remedies clause, or what I like to call the remedies clause, available to any aggrieved party. And there's no such clause, or at least, if I can turn it like this, a very watered-down clause, in the 2011 bill. We believe very strongly that the remedies clause in the 2003 bill should be reintroduced, and that's what I try to elaborate on in truly giving an enforcement mechanism or teeth to the language bill. Because if we have a language bill with no enforcement mechanism, as was enunciated in the 2003 bill, I believe such a bill, like I said, is paper law. It means nothing. What do language rights mean if we can't enforce them? So I hope that answers the second question, and then the question of language groups, if I can just try and assist there and answer that question, if the Honourable Member would just bear with me. The language groups, where I got it from, in a sense, was from the 2003 language bill. I think, if memory serves me correct, it was section 5 of the I believe it to be section 5 of the 2003 languages bill, which set up the policy clause, and as I've already elaborated on the use and promotion of indigenous languages on a rotational basis, for example, for publication and so forth. And all that we try to do with this submission regarding language policy is simply to say, be it at national level, be it at provincial level, be it at municipal level, to look at the issue pragmatically and practically, we simply must take account of English. But then also, as I have said, for us, a paramount paramount importance is the development of the indigenous languages and the previously marginalized languages. And in order to do so, and I think this might slot in with one of the next questions that the Honourable Mayor posed. We are here at national level trying to arrive at an answer, but not only at national, but also for people at a local level. And I would like to maybe stick out my toes and say that yes, I understand that, and it's not an easy task, but we must remember that certainly taking certain decisions at national level might not be felt the same way at municipal level. What I mean by that is if at national level a decision is made to, for example, in Papua or in the Northwest, to impose English as well as isiZulu or isiXhosa at national level, what will that be about to a person living in the Northwest or in Limpopo or in the Northern Cape? So that's why we really tried with the language groupings to say, or at least to try and arrive at what could possibly be construed as a normally accepted way of using English as well as all of the other indigenous languages, because that's important. In other words, let's develop all the indigenous languages, not only one or two of the other indigenous languages together with English, but let's give all of the other languages a chance. And we, in our submission, try to make the submission that this might be a plausible way of arriving at that end. And also, I think the next question, I'm not sure I understood it perfectly, about the minister providing further support. Oh, just a comment. Thank you. All right. I think I hope does that satisfy the speaker's questions. Thank you. All right.
Thank you, members. One last hand, if there is any. Brown to color. Umpopo, valo.
Thanks, Chair. From your point of view, to avoid duplication, what would the Office of the Ombudsman's role, I'm looking at the existing institutions that are actually in practice, and looking also at this office that we are proposing. What would be its role? I think I heard you talking about monitoring. I'm not quite clear if you can elaborate on that, and it's not enough, and if you can, yeah, that's all I can ask.
Okay.
Thank you. I think, just first with the point that I would like to make, in the submissions, clearly, like I said, we would like to see monitoring of language issues within the scope and within the already existing framework of the Pan-South African Language Board. I think that would be a good starting point. As I have said in the submissions also, we would not like to see duplication, or would at least try to avoid unnecessary duplication where this would indeed have a cost implication. The Office of the Ombudsman, in trying to answer the question further, I think it would be, and that's why I made the submission specifically to say, within the already existing framework of Pan-South, if I can term it like this, a much more cost-effective complaints mechanism, and then specifically, if I can term it like this, the person on the ground. A language of the, or an office of the language ombudsman, in our view, would be seen as a dispute resolution center of first instance for a person on the street, for the person on the ground, for any aggrieved party, but specifically with the issues of cost, because if we look at the prices of litigation nowadays, to take for any normal person to simply go to a high court and bring an application, or to a magistrate's court, but let's make it specifically the high court and the court system, it's expensive. So the Office of the Language Ombudsman would be an easily accessible and user-friendly forum regarding the resolution of language issues and language disputes. But there I do understand the question from the honorary member, and I have empathy for it. If within the already existing framework of PANSELP this issue can be addressed, then I would agree with it. So that would avoid unnecessary duplication. But then I would like to add a caveat to that, in that the role of the PANSELP African Language Board, then asked to be definitively strengthened in the 2011 Languages Bill, as it was within the, or in the context and in the confines of the 2003 Languages Bill. For example, if the members were to decide not to include such a clause providing for a language ombudsman, then we are left with nothing else regarding enforcement or monitoring than the Pan South African Language Board. And if the Pan South African Language Board, if I can term it like this, enjoys a status quo that it is enjoying now, then that will not be enough to enforce properly the mandate of the Constitution regarding constitutional rights. So if there's something like that, I would like to, it definitely be possible within the framework, but then the role of Pan South within the noble would definitely have to be redefined. I hope that answers the question. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Advocate Bray, and thanks for your time and thanks for submission. We really appreciate it. Thanks a lot. Okay. Okay, thanks a lot. And the next submission will come, it's a presentation by Professor Cornelius from the Vereniging van Rechtslee vir Afrikaans. Hope I said it correctly. Okay. It's a society of lawyers for Afrikaans. Are you using? Okay. Okay.
Madam Chair, thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak. We appreciate the fact that we can address the Honourable Committee in Afrikaans, but seeing that most of the presentations have been done in English, we'll continue on the same basis. Just also to save time as far as translation is concerned, we as professors are known for using a lot of time to discuss simple topics, so we'd rather not waste time on translation. With the permission, Madam Chair, I will just make a few opening remarks, but the majority of our presentation was written by my colleague at the University of Pretoria, Professor Chris Malan, so I will then pass on to him once I've made a few opening remarks. I think a lot of, as a society, a lot of our experiences with language is derived from the fact, firstly, that we deal with our clients across the racial spectrum, across the language spectrum, on a regular basis. And we have a lot of frustration at the moment with the fact that legislation is published in English and then on a very arbitrary fashion in one other language. A simple example is the Consumer Protection Act, which in my view should have been in all 11 official languages to empower consumers. It provides important consumer rights, and many consumers are disempowered as a result of the fact that it's not available to all of them. The other experience that we also gain is from our students. Not only current students, but also graduate students. You walk across them from time to time near the courts or wherever, and it's the same frustration that it makes it difficult for them to present the cases of their clients adequately, and also to explain the law to their clients adequately if it cannot be done in a language with which the client is fully conversant. The one honourable member asked the question earlier, what unifies us, or what should unify us in South Africa if it's not language? And my answer to that would be, Madam, to say that the unifying factor should be mutual respect for each other, for each other's values, for each other's languages, and for each other's culture. And if we can reach that stage in our country, then we will really be a unified nation. But under the current state where, and I'm not anti-English if I use this expression, but if you look at the language statistics, and I was going to mention a few, but Madam Chair showed me that clearly the committee is well versed with the statistics. But if you look at the language statistics, English is really a minority language in South Africa. It ends up fourth or fifth on, if you add all the first and second language speakers of English, it's still less than many of the first language speakers of some of the other languages. And therefore I feel that English, far from being a unifying factor, is actually a divisive factor, because it tends to oppress. As Ms. Donna also mentioned, it tends to oppress people rather than to empower them politically and economically. So if I can just mention one or two statistics. The Departments of Art, Culture, Science and Technology provided some information to UNESCO on language use. And in terms of that, 61% of South Africans have some even basic knowledge of English. But the converse of that means that there's 40% of our population, roughly, that cannot understand English. And the statistic doesn't tell us the demographics of this part of the population, but one can assume that it is spread across population groups. Which means that if you translate it into numbers, 16 to 18 million people simply cannot speak the language, and we have to accommodate them in one way or another. Added to that, research that was done by PANSAT a few years ago indicated that when they did a survey to test people's language skills, only 22% of the people surveyed fully understood political, administrative, policy statements and so on that were made exclusively in English. So the point is that even if English is your second or third language, and even if you are fully conversant in, accept that you are fully conversant in the language, it is sometimes still difficult to fully understand the implications of what is being said if it's not done in your own language. So as a society, our feeling is that this bill does not even go far enough in promoting multilingualism in South Africa. And as a society, we, of course, our first priority is promoting the use of Afrikaans, but we also strive towards multilingualism. We do not expect any favours or rights that we do not also grant to any other language group in South Africa. And therefore, our view is that the bill should be expanded on and that it should do more. But for that, I'm going to hand over to my colleague that he can explain our submission to in more detail. Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You will immediately hear that I'm Afrikaans speaking. Most probably you will also notice that I make some grammar mistakes. I'm quite proud of that. Ladies and gentlemen, I am going to direct myself towards some criticism of the language bill as it stands at the moment. I'm going to be fairly technical and practical. There might be some questions relating to, let's call it, the ideological background. I would be happy to answer such questions. But for the purposes of the presentation, I'll limit myself to the bill as it stands at the moment and to a critique thereof. Ladies and gentlemen, in the first instance, the basic characteristic of a constitution, inclusive of provisions in a constitution relating to language, is to lay it down, is to provide for a broad framework, is to provide for general principles. This is what the Constitution also in fact does in relation to the question of the official languages. In contrast to that, the basic aim of all legislation, inclusive also of legislation pertaining to language, should be to flesh out the broad framework provided for in the Constitution itself. In other words, to provide in full detail those aspects left out by the Constitution, those aspects which are simply dealt with by the Constitution on a broad and general fashion. This, namely the fact that a legislation should provide in detail for its subject matter, that truism is obviously borne out by legislation in various other fields that have been adopted in South Africa. For example, legislation regarding to administrative measures, PAJA, for the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, the Promotion of Access to Information Act, and so on and so forth. Those legislation is also based upon specific constitutional provisions, but such legislation actually does was expected of legislation, namely to flesh out in detail all the aspects that are not specifically touched on by the Constitution. This is also borne out by the comparative practice, which one, for example, finds in many language acts in various other jurisdictions, both outside and inside Africa. It's exactly in this regard where the problem with the present language bill starts. Because I'm afraid to say that the present language bill unfortunately does not even begin to do that. Let me explain. As far as we are concerned, a language bill, a language act rather, and this we say with reference to comparative practice elsewhere in the world, should provide for the following five aspects. Let me mention them. In the first instance, it should indicate how state organs should communicate with the public, both orally and in writing, in all matters that pertain to the public interest. Which languages should be used and when the official languages should be used. That's firstly. Secondly, a language act should provide in full detail for language-related rights, individual rights of the public. Thirdly, a language act, and this is very important, should provide for the way in which organs of state should organize themselves in order to make it possible for members of the public to exercise those rights. Because rights can only be fulfilled, rights can only be exercised if the state is organized in such a way as to realize and to materialize those rights. So in other words, the Language Act should in considerable detail set out the precise way in which organs of state should organize themselves. Fourthly, a Language Act should also indicate precisely how organs of state should go about in their interaction as far as language is concerned with the public. Lastly, it should provide for certain remedies or penalties in the event where it might occur that the provisions in the Language Act, the first four that I've mentioned, have not been complied with. Now the problem with the present bill as it currently stands is, and I know it might sound harsh, but I'm afraid that is unfortunately the case, but the present bill as it is standing now fails to do so. It simply repeats the general principle laid down in the Constitution, Section 6, namely that of parity of esteem and equitable treatment, but it does not go any further in fleshing out and in describing in detail what these aspects mean in practice. In other words, instead of addressing those questions in detail, what is the basic thing that should be addressed by a Language Act, this Language Act actually postpones it, and in that way it refuses to actually deal with the basic aspect that a Language Act should in fact be dealing with. To that end, our proposal is that the bill as it presently stands should actually be redesigned in order to provide for the five aspects that we have referred to. Now to that end, our proposal would be that the Act should be redesigned, and that the following basic aspects should be addressed in full detail in the bill that eventually should become the new Language Act. In the first instance, there should be detailed provisions on the way in which all organs of state should be communicating in the various official languages with the public. In the second instance, and this is a very practical question, but precisely because it's a practical question, it must be addressed by a Language Act. This is, very often, as a matter of fact, on numerous occasions, the public communicates with orders of state through forms that are filled out, forms that are completed, in which application is made, for example, for licenses, for social grants, and so on and so forth. So language in that particular context obviously plays a crucial role. So for that reason, Language Act should in detail address the question of forms. In other words, that forms to be completed, to be filled out by members of the public, should be available in the various languages so as to enable members, speakers of the various languages, to be afforded state services in the language of preference. If a Language Act does not do that, then it's a serious failure. This is a practical aspect, but precisely because it is such a practical aspect, it must be dealt with by a Language Act. In both cases, ladies and gentlemen, the first two aspects that I've mentioned, namely the detailed provision regarding the way in which organs of state should communicate with the members of the public in various languages, as well as the question of forms, which is one of the means of publication. The question, and I know full well that this is a thorny question, but I'm going to address it. In both these contexts, the question of demographics plays a crucial role. For example, there is no need, I would say, most certainly, for forms to be made available in Limpopo province, in Isikosa. Simply because the vast majority of the population in that province speaks Setswana and Venda. But most certainly, the forms in that case should be available in those two languages. Preferably in all languages, but most certainly in those two languages. Apart from that, the staff employed in that particular area should also be conversant in those languages. If not, such state organs in that province would be incapable of providing both oral as well as written services to the public in that particular province. Now this brings us to the third, and I can mention many other examples pertaining to other areas in the country that can demonstrate this point. This brings me to the question of human resources policy. Ladies and gentlemen, this is where the question of representativity comes into play. We know that the question of representativity is a very important foundation of the policy of the present government. We can also understand why it's important, and there's also no way in which one can generally make a case against representation. However, the question of representation should not be applied in such a way as to forfeit and as to completely cancel out, so to say, the question of multilingualism. So in other words, for that reason we are saying that the Language Act should also specifically address the question of human resource policy. Why is that so important? Simply because of the fact, by way of example, that if one employs an Afrikaans-speaking person like me in Tata, and an Afrikaans-speaking person like me who speaks Afrikaans and who speaks a little bit of English, is obviously not competent to serve people in Umtata until and unless I reach the point where I can speak the language of that particular area. So in other words, the question of language proficiency is a very important aspect in the competence of the people to be appointed in various areas. So in other words, what we are saying is this: let representativity as a crucial aspect of the human resources policy run its course, but let it do so in conjunction with the question of the language demographics and language preferences in all the various areas in the country, in the various districts, in the various provinces, and so on and so forth. In that way, we can achieve not only representativity, and in that way achieve employment equity, but simultaneously we can also achieve multilingualism and providing proper services in the language of preference to the various sections, and eventually also to our population, our national population in its entirety. Let me say this. At the moment, this bill, as it now stands, is avoiding that point. I suspect the reason why the bill is avoiding that point is because representativity is such a crucial point. It is because this is regarded as one of the cornerstones of government policy, is one of the cornerstones of the whole transformation drive. That's the reason why it's avoided, I would guess. But let me add, as I've already said, and let me reiterate that, there is no necessary mutual exclusion between representativity on the one hand and multilingualism and provision of proper services to various communities on the other hand. These two principles can in fact be married, they should be married, and the place where this question should be addressed is precisely in a language bill. Currently that does not happen. We would urge from the viewpoint of the Vereniging van Regsluier vir Afrikaans that this point be addressed, since that is one of the crucial aspects without which a proper language act can eventually not be adopted. Let me also add that if one also compares this point with best international practice, one would see that is in fact perfectly in line with that. You don't find a language act anywhere in the world which does not specifically address human resources policy, because human resources policy and the language proficiency of employers of all sorts of state is a basic prerequisite for multilingualism and for providing services in the languages and languages of various sections of the public. As far as this point is concerned, let me also mention this. If a person is let me use this example again. If I am appointed in Umtata, I am certainly incompetent since I cannot speak the language and therefore cannot provide proper services in that particular area. If a person who is a speaker of only English, for example, is appointed in Pretoria, Botswana if you like, that person once again is simply not competent for that particular area, because that person cannot speak the languages of the communities living in that particular area. I think this is a very important point. The question of human resource policy, which should be a crucial and salient feature of a language act. Fourthly, the language act should also provide for policy relating to the publication of reports and notices which are of interest to the public in general. That's the fourth point. The fifth point, it should also provide for remedies and for penalties in the event of organs of state failing to comply to the detailed provisions set out in the Act. Chairperson, my colleague Professor Cornelis has mentioned that the question of the language that is used for the purposes of the publication of legislation is also not addressed in the bill as it currently stands. This is a crucial point. We would like to see this point also be addressed. Legislation is obviously the most important tool of government, so consequently one cannot conceive of a language act which fails to address this particular point. There must be a proper policy that sets out in precise detail which considerations should be taken into account in selecting which languages would be used for various aspects of for various pieces of legislation, which languages should in fact be used. In conclusion, we are afraid to say that the current bill, and we do not, it's not our choice in the first instance to level such seemingly harsh criticism, unfortunately does not even start to address the basic problems and the basic questions that should in fact be addressed by a language act. We would argue that the 5 points that I've tried to set out should in fact be included in such a language act, and that these 5 points should in detail be thrashed out by whoever is responsible for that, and that should in fact be included in a proper language act for which there is indeed a dire need in South Africa, which, and let me add that, in also in line with what my colleague Professor Cordelis has said, this, if we have a proper language act, this is something that can bind us. This is something which can be a common denominator for a common South African nationhood. Very often in Africa, all of us know that, since we do not have one language, which is the national language of a particular state, very often the choice has been one of straight to English. This is not a means of creating unity. As a matter of fact, many people, including myself, resent that, and many other people also. That include Afrikaners, and include African people, and so on. And I was very happy to hear what Ms. Donna had said, in this regard. We should, in conclusion then, we would urge that the 5 points that I've tried to explain should in fact be properly addressed and included in such an act in order to give full effect to the Constitution and also to promote and enhance the indigenous languages and also to promote and enhance proper South African nationhood on the basis of something which is of real content. Thank you.
Thank you for the presentation. No, I'm looking for hands. Any other member? Anyone of Shilubana? Okay.
Your Honourable Chair, I quite agree with the presenters that in a case where all the litigants, including the officer, speak the same language, interpretation of that evidence really is wasting time. But at the same time, the government is talking of cohesion in this country. My question now is, if an Afrikaner matter is being dealt with by Afrikaners and a Xhosa matter is being dealt with by the Xhosas, are we not going back to that segregation now? I don't think really this country will need that by now. So that is the question I'm putting to the presenters. Are we not now, by their suggestion, going back to the segregation? Thank you, Honourable Chairperson.
Faku, uthi ucela uphinde umbuzo wakho akawuvanga.
I am saying I agree with both presenters. When litigants, including the presiding officer, are all speaking the same language, really interpreting such cases is a waste of time. And I agree with them, it causes backlogs. But in a situation where a matter of the Xhosa has to be dealt with by the Xhosa magistrate, prosecutor, and all the staff, and the matter of an Afrikaner is being dealt with by the African speaking people, are we not now going back to segregation? Does this country need that at this time? That is my question.
Did you get the question? Okay.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I also would like to agree with what my colleague has said. But there was an interesting case that I listened in court. While the interpretation was a lot of time, where the interpreter was trying to interpret what was said by the other party, you know, simply saying in my language, "Tloko ya manuawe," "Tloko ya maho." So the literal translation was,
"Your mother."
He's saying, "It is your mother's head." Then the judge said, "What's wrong with that?" But in our own language, when a person says "Tloko ya manawe" or "Tloko ya maho," it's an insult. But because the person who's the judge himself or the magistrate is not that language speaker, the translation is, "What's wrong when a person says it has your mother's head?" So when the case was dismissed. But let me come to this, that when we speak of transformation and proficiency of languages, you always imagine a community which is not too rural, but I come from a rural community where I witnessed a person coming to apply for a child grant, for instance. This year, this person cannot even read what is written here, pump or whatever. So there was one person who was trying to translate orally to this group of women. And until where this one person, you know, just got tired and wrote whatever she thought was coming to her head. Now, I just want to know, to find out whether there's any remedy to that, you know, it's a limitation or a backlog or whatever. For I know government is doing a lot with adult education, but we still have a long way to go. In the rural area, it's really pathetic. So I don't know, how do you think we can craft this legislation in order to accommodate everyone in South Africa? Thank you.
Thank you. I was going to take... are you going to take the last question? Okay.
Chairperson, maybe one should also add this, to say the presenter was indicating that there are five aspects that need to be included in the bill. And in the interpretation of all of those, or in the absence of all those aspects, one will assume that or suggest that without the inclusion of the five aspects, that means the bill itself should go back for rewriting or for reconsideration and so on and so on. Bearing in mind that we have got maybe one thing that we need to do. We all agree that the South African Language Bill or the Act itself is an important thing. And we'll have to persuade and find out ways and means in order to bring it to light. That is what I think we should be doing. But if we reverse the bill at this stage, and on the other hand, there is a court, you know, pushing in it that it is in order to address some other concerns with other people, we need to look the ways and means. What if you bring in something that needed to be included in the bill as it is now? If there are some omissions and gaps, bring it, because in a public hearing of this nature, we need your own submission that will make it possible for us to do with this bill and find out it correctly to cater what is needed by the Act itself and also in the Constitution. That is my argument. More so, when you talk about the demographics, as my colleagues has already indicated, the representativity in the human resource, I think we need to find out a way that will cater both, not trying to literally say an Afrikaner cannot be employed in an area where you know, where indigenous group of people are living, as he indicating literally to say, are we not going back to what we have been saying, we don't want it any longer in this country? It's not an argument to say at this time and point, let's find out means and ways how to deal with this in order to promote the act itself and what is contained in the Constitution. We are not arguing in the sense that one is not saying good and one is not saying it correctly, but let's try to focus what is it that we are here for. Are we not making submissions that need to be included if there are some omissions in the bill itself? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Professor Konada? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll answer the first two questions and then my colleague can answer the last question. I share your concern, Honourable Member, about the possibility that one could go back to the bad old days if this is not carefully addressed. But what we are saying is not, as this Honourable Member also mentioned, we're not saying that an Afrikaner cannot be appointed in Mthatha, or that and someone speaking isiXhosa cannot be appointed in Gauteng or whatever. That is not the position, but if, for instance, and I share his position, if I am appointed in Umtata to be a magistrate, for instance, then either there should be a process to ensure, first of all, that I can speak the language, or I should be trained. There's no reason why people cannot be trained in the languages as well. We were fortunate now with our new vice-chancellor at the University of Pretoria. And interestingly, with a surname like De La Rey, you would expect different. But when she arrived there, she could hardly speak Afrikaans. And the other day when we spoke in a meeting, we mentioned something. She said, but she answered us in fluent in Afrikaans. So it's a mindset shift that also should take place. That if you serve a particular community, then take the trouble to understand the community and to participate. We had a situation that we as society addressed with the Department of Justice, and eventually they started to see our point, where a magistrate was appointed in a small town in the Northern Cape who could exclusively only speak English. Now, there's hardly a person in that district that speaks a word of English. And the magistrate couldn't understand a word of any other language other than English. And that, we are saying, is a problem, because that magistrate cannot render a service to that particular community. I was a public prosecutor in my very young days, and that is before the 1994 changes, in 1991, for a very short while. I didn't spend a lot of time in the courts, but I got the experience there of how the translator system work, the interpreters. That we have one case, and people laugh at this, and it seems funny, but not if you are the accused sitting there. There was one situation in the court where the charge was read in Afrikaans to the accused, who was, I can't remember which of the African languages this person was speaking. The interpreter then had to put the charge and just ask, do you plead guilty or not guilty? And there was a long discussion between the interpreter and the accused. And eventually the magistrate said, but, you know, how difficult is this? Just say guilty or not guilty. And the interpreter's reply was, well, he says he's not guilty, but if you give me 5 more minutes, you'll plead guilty. Now, it sounds funny, but that is an incredible abuse of system. It totally destroys the rights of that particular accused to a fair trial. And that is the kind of situation that we are saying should be addressed. We should, and that's the situation we had before 1994, where we made use of interpreters where the magistrate or the judge could not, in many instances, understand the language and did not know if the interpreter was making a mistake. So it's crucial that from that point of view, it would be more integrating if we can promote the use of all languages. So that is, and I trust that allays your fear, that the idea is not to look at segregation, but to be more inclusive in all aspects. Then the other question by the other honourable member was relating to how to improve the position in the rural areas, and that is exactly the point that we make, that this bill should address, that forms should be made available in all the official languages. I referred in my introduction to the Consumer Protection Act, which I think, from a commercial point of view, is probably the most important piece of legislation that has been passed since the 1994 Constitution. As a consumer, I couldn't wait for some of those provisions, and I'm a lawyer, and I've been short done in consumer contracts. So now we have this wonderful consumer rights, but the majority of the population cannot read, can maybe read it, but they cannot fully comprehend the rights that are granted there. And that act should actually be in all 11 official languages, so that anybody can take a copy. It should have been published in little booklets like we did with the Constitution in 1994, so that any consumer who goes to a shop can look at that in their own language and say, but this shop is not treating me fairly, or the service provider, whoever, it's not treating me fairly, I've got rights and I can stand on my rights. And that is what we are trying to achieve, that everybody can get access to justice in that way, and that we empower people to understand for themselves. Obviously, as lawyers, it's often in our interest that people don't understand the law too much. But even if you understand particular provisions in an act, there are no other intricacies. And obviously also you can't argue your own case. You're not objective enough. So it lawyers would always be necessary. But the point is, it would make our jobs much easier if our clients could understand the law in their own language and deal with it on that basis. And if we are more inclusive, especially in the rural communities, by providing the services in the language of their choice. In 1994, I was also fortunate enough to be appointed as an election officer. And we were flown all over KwaZulu-Natal to assist at some of the polling stations. Now, I know that's almost 20 years ago. It's amazing to think if you start counting the years. But we literally landed in some of the rural areas where there was hardly anybody who could speak English. And we couldn't really make much of a contribution in those districts. What we needed was someone who spoke isiZulu and who could converse. So we made use of interpreters quite a lot. But it would have been much better if we didn't have to use the interpreters. Because things get lost. The example was mentioned by the one honorable member now. I can, you know, as kids we used to play this, what we in Afrikaans call telefoonkie. You sit in a circle and one person would say a line to the next and they would whisper it all around. And by the time the message got back to the first person, it's something totally different from what it started with. And that is the risk of translation. So I hope if we can be more inclusive with languages, we can address also the service delivery in the rural areas. The last question I'll just leave again to my colleague. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you. We dealt with the various aspects that have been excluded, but I take the point, sir, that these aspects should in fact be addressed in a full-fledged proposal, the five aspects. And from our side, we will attend to that and we'll quickly submit it to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you, Member. Is there any other question? No, Moss? Is there any other question? Okay. What time is it now? What time is the court watch? Few minutes. 3 past. There's no other question here. Lastly, can I ask Mr. Solo from Parliament just to come? It's Grace. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot.
One minute, our program is a captive.
Johnny, I didn't say you were saying.
5 minutes and 20. Thank you, Chair. Honourable members, guests, and honourable members, our guests, and all language practitioners present. Chair, I will be very brief. My name is M.K. Sithole. I'm a senior language practitioner for isiZulu in Hanford Language Services. I present with co-presenters Mr. T.P. Nduli, seated over there. He's a senior language practitioner for isiNdebele. And Mr. B.G. Mani, who is a senior language practitioner for isiXhosa. Chair, we present here as language activists. We don't represent any view of Hansard or Parliament. The issues we wanted to make input on are just technical issues in the bill. We wanted on section 1 on definitions to add a definition of a language practitioner. We will explain the reasons why we need that designation to be included and have a definition. Also, this proposal relates to certain clarifications around the accountability and the reporting lines, which clause 11, section 3.15 of the memorandum to this bill explains, which provides that the relevant minister must table in Parliament the annual report for her or his own department on the status of the use of languages by the national government for government purposes. That area may not be clear in terms of how that accountability output is complied with in terms of the use of language. And also on page 5, section 9, subsection 2, the bill stipulates that the National Language Unit must report to the Minister on the activities of the National Language Unit and any other language units in the departments. It further stipulates that the National Language Unit must report to the Minister any complaints received regarding the use of official languages in the national government and the manner in which these complaints were dealt with. So we have a proposal to say the designation National Language Unit should be amended, and in the bill we insert a designation that says National Language Services Directorate. We propose that this National Language Unit should be a chief directorate on its own. This will help to clear the roles and responsibilities compared to a unit which for business purposes shall be subordinate to another business unit. A National Language Services Directorate shall have clear and reasonable powers to deal with complaints immediately and report on outcomes and persistent challenges as required by the bill. So we are of the view that if it's a unit, it may not have clear and enough powers to deal with these complaints immediately, because it will be subordinate to another business unit. A directorate shall have broad structural base to accommodate language experts for the overall implementation of all language-related policies as regulated in schedules of Public Finance Management Act 1 of 1999. This will help all the departments to properly align their communication and language services units and merge them under one directorate for purposes of equality of languages and service delivery. We also want to submit, Chair, that Section 4 on page 3, subsection 2, subclause B, which relates to at least two official languages, be amended, and we insert a clause that says majority of spoken official languages. If not so, we say one of which, with these two languages, one of which must be an official language of a previously disadvantaged community. We have simply reasons for that, Chairperson, and a number of presenters did touch on that issue to say we might have a situation whereby those people who are responsible for designing languages identify English as one of those two languages and then Afrikaans. And you find that there was no need maybe for English. It could be enough if it's Zulu and Afrikaans, or Zulu, because everybody now is excited with English. Everything is English. So we also want to give the background to the aforegoing proposal that this subsection provides that the language policy to be adopted must identify at least two official languages that a national department, national public entity, or national public enterprise will use for government purposes. This does not talk to the emphasis of the proposed bill to promote previously disadvantaged South African languages. And there is a tendency in our society, as time goes on, people feel ashamed to say there are languages that were previously disadvantaged, which we should not be shy to say. We should keep on saying that so that these languages get promoted and they enjoy the same parity of esteem like English. Chair, this amendment shall help to promote previously disadvantaged official languages and avoid ambiguity as it relates to English and Afrikaans. On page 4, section 5, we propose that we delete the concept personnel, and I'm happy that the presenter that presented recently spoke about the issue of human resource. We want to propose here that we delete personnel, because personnel is too vague. This is an act which talks about language, which talks about the promotion of language, for languages to enjoy the parity of esteem. Therefore, it should also talk about specific experts in the field of language. We propose that because language as such is an area of specialization. So now if you say personal, I have noted in many organizations, there are people who are in leadership of language business units, yet they don't have the required qualifications, knowledge, or other expertise in the field of language. I'm trying to finish now. Then, also on page 5, section 9, subsection 1, subclause C, the provision that says any complaint received regarding the use of previously the provision that is in section 9 subsection 1 subclause C should add the word marginalized and should read as follows: any complaint regarding the use of previously marginalized official language in the national government and the manner in which these complaints were dealt with. So we just want marginalized to be added and precede the word official languages. And also on page 5, section 10, it says the national language unit may request the minister or the cabinet member responsible. So we wanted the concept may be replaced with the concept must, because on emphasis the bill must have certain provisions that make it possible for these provisions to be enforceable. Then, in conclusion, Chair, we wish to express our concern around the No, this one is not important, Chairperson. Yeah, thank you. Now, the Chairperson wants me to read this. In conclusion, Chairperson, we wish to express our concern around the consultation process. In terms of the memorandum, the consultation process did not involve stakeholders in the legislative sector. By legislative sector, I mean all the provincial legislatures, including the national parliament, sectorally in language units. So, that is by the department, Chairperson. Yes. Yeah, so in fact I said the drafters. I do not know who it affects, but those who were responsible. Thank you.
Mr. Tolapasa, I say you must clarify it by whom, so that we can be clear, because anyone who can read it can think it's us. So don't be a coward. Okay, this is the last question. Are there any questions or any comments? The Honorable Lotret?
Okay. Thank you, Chair. it is purely a comment, and I think it's just very important. I'm very glad that we had this presentation this afternoon, because I think we forgot the importance of the language practitioners and the fact that in order to provide a language service, it requires skill and expertise. And I think this is something that we've basically just forgotten about. So thank you.
Hakombuzo? Okay. We have come to the end of the program. Is Mr. Peters still here? Yes. I think just lastly to respond to the issue that we spoke about earlier in terms of the constitution and as I explained to you, the legal opinion as well from Parliament is saying exactly what I was saying in terms of the issue of sign language. But the opinion of legal, it says even though Section 6 1 does not recognize the sign language as an official language, what we can do, as we spoke about the angle, is that a such legislative provision then can compel government to promote and protect sign language specifically in areas dealing with education, labor, relations, judicial process and social services. Not to say that the other sectors cannot, are not, but specifically these ones that would be affecting. But I think our conversation with the DG earlier will also be part of the provision of this bill, which is still a bill, because if there is a constitutional amendment that is desirable, obviously the committee as itself cannot take that legislative decision, then it must still go to the constitutional review committee in Parliament, and then what we can do is relevant groups can submit similar constitutional amendments, because so that it can be sent to the Joint Constitutional Review Committee. As you know, obviously it's not only the people who live with the disability of being deaf that are more concerned about the issue of sign language. I think everyone, every South African is very concerned. Some is just ignorance at this level. It's a serious concern that needs just intense lobbying as well, because all of us are really concerned as well, because if it is amended, it will also change the mindsets of our own people as well. I think it was just an omission. Okay. Members, is there anything?
Madam Chair, may I just say thank you very much. I'm thrilled to bits. You'll get it all finished off by tomorrow close of business, will you?
Okay. I would really appreciate it. I've got a note that says, how old are you, Chair? I I think some people are humorous, you know, or this is how old I use. I don't know what is the reason. Okay, I'm 34 years old. I don't hide in my age.
Sorry, Chair. Sorry, Chair. Sorry, Chair. That was confidential.
They say a woman must not hide her age. I don't hide my age. So, I'd like to say to everyone who is here, teach me. I'm not going to
No, Chair, I want to abuse the platform. But safe to say, Chair, that we will provide a comprehensive response to the committee at the appropriate time on the views of the department on the input.
Thank you. I'd like to say to everyone who's there, thank you for coming today. The public hearings are still continuing tomorrow on the third hall. And I thought of the gentleman who came, there is no limitation of who comes in. Everyone can come in, and I think the more I receive the submission, the better. I know the deadline has been closed, but it will be harder to get. So, one gentleman was saying, Professor Omotosu wants to come, and everyone is welcome to come. It's open to the public, it's open to everyone. And please go home safely, drive safely, enjoy the heat. Thank you.
Okay.